This episode of Legion of News is made possible by our friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
High atop the milkpacking district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Dawn Taylor, who is, even now, as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
The mom of Columbia Sportswear is held at gunpoint. The Where's Waldo Bandit breaks his silence, and the Humane Society aims to spay and neuter more cats than ever.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, steel yourselves! For this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon, I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Thursday, November 11th, 2010. Columbia Sportswear Chairman Gert Boyle was held briefly at gunpoint as a man tried to burglarize her home Wednesday night. But Boyle's quick thinking alerted police quickly, and the suspect was captured overnight.
Stick a bastard in it, you crap!
West Lynn police said the home...
No love for the Futurama reference.
That was funny.
Okay, fine, whatever.
I smiled. I mean, you know, the people
at home...
I'm sure
that carried very well for the audience.
Do you want this Ed McMahon thing where I just go, ha, 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 that was good, Johnny, every time you do a joke?
Yes, I do. I'm glad you asked that, Don, because I didn't want to have to come out and proactively request such a thing. But yes, the answer is yes. In fact, I'll get a series of signs. One that says guffaw, one that says chortle. One that says, titter.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know how to titter.
Okay, well, you can learn. I mean, okay. You know, I know it's a learning curve, and it's a bit of a steep climb sometimes, but I have faith in you.
Oh, thank you.
You have initiative, you have motivation.
I have nerves of steel.
Well, not so much.
No, not really.
Here's Dawn Taylor.
Westland Police said the home invasion began just before 7 p.m. when Boyle pulled into her garage. She told police that a man carrying a basket and a book approached her and asked if she'd sign the book. She told him she wasn't interested, and then he pulled out a gun. At that point, she told the man that she needed to turn off her house alarm, but instead she set off the panic alert, which sends a message straight to the police. Officers arrived moments later and found Boyle with her hands bound. A police sergeant also said saw the suspect running from the home, and police dogs and crews began a manhunt. The suspect was later identified as Gabriel Nestor Caballero and was spotted by police in a nearby McDonald's just before midnight. He'll face several charges, including burglary, robbery, and kidnapping.
So what does it do with her? Is she just sort of like a figurehead for the company, or does she actually do anything for them?
Well, she's still the chairman.
But
so
I mean,
it's like that's like she... She, I think she has to go to, you know, board meetings now and then, and just they cut her a check.
But like, did she start the company? Did she found the company?
Her parents founded it as Columbia Hat Company in the 1930s after they came over here fleeing from Nazi Germany.
And then she actually, and then did she, is she the one that transitioned it into being like a more generalized sportswear company?
Yeah, it became Columbia Sportswear. She and her husband turned it into Columbia Sportswear. He died in 1970, and she's been running it. She was running it on her own ever
since. She's sort of, she's not so much the Betty Crocker. She is like the Mrs. Fields of Columbia Sportswear.
Exactly.
Good for her. Awesome. By the way, Mrs. Fields, hot. Hot as balls.
She was a fine-looking woman.
She still is, by the way. I met her just a couple years ago. I mean, you know, in her mid-60s, but still a tigress. So, and I'm saying makes a... No, seriously.
Is there a story there, Rick Emerson, about you and Mrs. Fields?
Would that there was. I'm just saying I met her... I guess it was actually...
Her cookies?
No. Well, I mean, yes. I don't know. What's correct? I don't know. Maybe. But I met her, and she was one of those... This sounds weird, but sort of like a... Sort of like a slightly better preserved Lucille Bluth, you know, in the sense that she didn't seem like she was going to fall over all the time. You know, she didn't seem like she was half in the bag. Apparently lives a very clean lifestyle. Was on her third husband, if I recall correctly. But, I mean, that just means that she, you know, she wore the others out.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you going to do?
Not anymore.
By the way, and
be
she
gone.
Makes, let me just tell you about Mrs. Fields. They make this cookie. They make this thing every now and again. It's like a, and I typically don't go for the, I typically don't forget like macadamia stuff. Mm-hmm. But they make this this peanut butter macadamia cookie every now and again. It's like the best thing you've ever had in your life. It's unbelievable.
I'll keep that in mind.
All right. Here's Don Taylor.
The man federal agents dubbed the Where's Waldo Bandit spoke publicly for the first time today on the radio about the allegations he's facing. Ryan Homsley is accused of robbing a Key Bank branch in Tualatin in September. He was taken into custody a few days later at a Willamette Valley hospital. Federal officials gave him the nickname based on bank surveillance images from the robbery. You know, he had glasses and a striped sweater, so... Where's Waldo? Noah Homsley, Homsley's brother and Portland radio host on KUFO, better known as Porkchop, said he received a call Tuesday from his brother at the Multnomah County Jail, and I get a collect call on my phone as we're on the air, he said. Live on the air, Ryan Homsley talked about the incident and why he went to the hospital afterwards. I had to have surgery on my right arm, he told his brother. It was either lose my right arm or go to jail and lose my right arm.
Uh-huh.
What?
Spatial relations.
I went and had surgery done, and when I woke up, there were two FBI agents waiting in my room. Don Homsley says his brother has a drug problem and also suffers from diabetes. He suspects that's why he sought medical care. Asked if he was under the influence of something when he went to the bank, Noah replied, no, I was sober as a priest on Sunday or a DJ at 4 in the morning.
Yeah, wah. See, that's right there
Need
the...
As a priest on Sunday or a DJ at 4 in the morning.
That's where you need the Ed McMahon prompt there to know where the humor is to be found.
There we go.
Hey, speaking of Ed McMahon, just as a side note, did you ever read that article that the...
It's the
thing where... Just shout your answers from the back of the room. What are you looking for?
I'm trying to print the sound, and it just keeps not coming off of the printer. And never mind.
Okay.
It's been just hanging up. I'm sorry. Go on. Listening.
You
I'm
know,
in the room.
I could try printing it.
Okay. Would you please?
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, kids, you're listening to Legion of News, where everything is executed flawlessly and where we cover even our most egregious mistakes with a thin veneer of cool so that you, the listener, never know the chaos happening behind the scenes. We are right here at Cascadia.fm. We thank you for joining us. Coming up later on the hour, we have Science on the March, also your entertainment news for Thursday and so forth. If you'd like to get this program on your mobile device, you can do that. It's mobile.cascadia.fm, mobile. Cascadia.fm. You can get this program via iTunes later on today or as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at legionofnews.com. I endeavor to do some printification over here on this side. Don Taylor has more stories of sustenance for you.
I do indeed. The Oregon Humane Society held a free spay and neuter clinic for cats today with the goal of setting a record for the most surgeries in one day.
Is that like one of those lip lock marathons they would do in the 60s where couples would just kiss for 150 hours?
It's exactly like that, only with them cutting open cats.
How many testicles can we remove today?
The OHS medical team scheduled 200 surgeries today. Veterinarians say that's about four times the number of cats spayed and neutered on an average day. Honestly, really, what could go wrong? If they're just rushing through these and try to do as many as possible. I mean, they're just cats. It's not like people are attached to them or anything.
Well, but how many moving parts can a cat possibly have? And I mean, really, it seems like there's a finite number of ways to do that surgery, you know? Your sac is either still attached and you're doing full of stuff or it's not, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's either, look, it's not like a glass half empty, half full. It's a sac totally empty or totally full. It's a binary equation, I think.
But I mean, some cats, when you spay the cat, they have to actually, like, do real surgery.
Which one is the female thing? Is that the spaying?
Neutering is when they remove the testicles.
Why do they call it spaying? What does that mean? I mean, I know what the actual procedure is. Or do I? Is that a cauterizing thing, or is it like a tying thing, or are they removing something?
I believe it used to be tying, but now I think they cauterize. I don't know.
It's like fallopian tubes or whatever,
right,
where they just seal it all shut?
Yeah.
Hey, I have a question. I'm not saying you're a cat as such, but if you're getting the fallopian tubes, you know, like the if you're getting them cauterized, which means they're closed off, what? I don't mean to sound like a fifth grader here, but does stuff just pile up in there, or?
The body reabsorbs.
Really?
The eggs.
It just sits there and goes, well, they don't seem to be moving. Yeah. We'll just through the walls.
Yeah, they're just it's just matter, and they're very small celled organisms. So yeah, your body just absorbs them.
Go nature. All right,
yeah.
Fair enough. So anyways, where is this happening, and when is this? They want people to bring their cats down.
Yeah, this is the Oregon Humane Society. They've actually scheduled 200 surgeries already, and then five other animal organizations collaborated to complete another 200. The event already filled up, but the Animal Shelter of Alliance of Portland is sponsoring a year-round Portland to help subsidize the costs of spaying and neutering cats. So if you want to be involved in this, if you want to get your cat spayed or neutered inexpensively, you can go to spaysave.org. The cost will be $10 to get your cat spayed or neutered. Or you can call 503-802-6755.
Really, let me urge you on behalf of all right-thinking citizens everywhere to have that done to your cat and possibly to your children. I mean, if they're willing to perform the procedure, just because, you know.
Yeah, I never had my cat spayed, and you're supposed to, because it's actually better for them, their health. You know, even if they're indoor cats and they're not in danger of getting pregnant or anything, it's better for them. But I never got my cat spayed. And now every once in a while, she just she gets into what we call her mood. And she just kind of walks around going, I sure would like a boyfriend.
Oh, man.
And we're like, shut up. She's like, okay. She makes this weird little noise all the time.
As opposed to, what is it? And do spade cats just, because you get like the dog that comes home from the vet and he just looks at you with that. The dog, if you get the dog neutered, they have that look of betrayal on their face for a while, where it's just like, you said we were going to the park. You said we were going to go get a steak. They took my manhood, you know, and they sort of glare at you for a while. But then, you know, but it's like Max and Philo are both neutered. But this is where you get a good sense of like what, you know, it's like just like your brain being on drugs, of like what male on hormone is sort of like. Because Philo is just so twitchy and jumpy and just freaks out about stuff all the time. And Max is... He's like a little polar bear / Hitler. You know, he's just like this little white fluffy ball of hate who just wants to conquer and dominate everything.
He looks so adorable, though.
Yeah, but he's not. That's the thing. I mean, he is in the sort of he's adorable in the sense that I identify with his evil. But he's just always picking fights with everybody, and he thinks the whole neighborhood belongs to him. And he tried to attack a Rottweiler that lives down the street, and it was just he's just retarded. But it's like, but that's with him neutered. I can't even imagine what he would be like if he had, you know, like his actual testicles, you know?
Yeah, my previous cat was a male cat, and he was, you know, he got from kitten stage to, like, sort of teenage cat stage. And honestly, it was like, suddenly the only thing he wanted in life was to get out of the house. I don't think he had any idea what was going on out there, but he had to get out of the house.
Well, he just knew that it was more exciting than what was happening with mom and dad.
Something hormonal kicked in, and he had to get out of the house. And finally, it reached this point where we accidentally broke a window, and we boarded it up with cardboard. And he managed to, like, claw the cardboard away at one point and was wiggling his way out the window and cut himself on the broken glass. And I had to take him to the vet and go, would you please fix my cat? Oh, yeah, and sew up this gash on his side where he tried to get out the window. And after he was fixed, we went through that whole thing where, you know, he had the cone on his head and everything healed up. And I swear, it was like with a dog. He'd look down every once in a while, washing himself, and then realize there were no balls there.
Right.
And then just look at us like, what
Damn
did you.
You
do?
Damn you!
What did you do?
Yeah. You were listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. This is Don Taylor.
Some active and retired members of TriMet's union spent yesterday morning protesting outside a TriMet board meeting at Portland State University. The workers say they want to call attention to their ongoing labor dispute with the transit agency and the battle over health care costs in any new contract. The union also accused TriMet of not including the union in addressing safety issues. However, TriMet released a statement today saying two operators were included in its Safety and Service Excellence Task Force. TriMet says its staff members are now working on new safety plans that will include input from employees. The union also addressed an Oregonian article reporting that some drivers earn salaries at or near $100,000 per year. Union members say TriMet has not hired any new drivers in a year, and the only way to keep service up and running is for drivers to work extensive overtime, resulting in inflated salaries.
I'm unclear about this. Is the $100,000 the base salary, or is that the result of the overtime?
That's the result of the overtime.
Oh, well, you know.
But still.
So if you're firing guys, and then everybody else has got to pick up the slack, then it seems like you're going to be working more. And plus, overtime is like, that's like time and a half at most places, right?
And they're driving buses.
Yeah, but you know what? You couldn't do it. Neither could I. So, and you know, and plus, have you seen the people who ride the bus? I mean, honestly. It's like the last three rungs on the humanity ladder. So, I mean, you know, whatever. I don't care. And whatever keeps... I'm not trying to pass judgment on everybody who rides TriMet, because I've done it, for a lot of the time I lived in Portland, and it's, you know, sometimes you just got to take a bus, and sometimes it's, you only have one car, or there's bad weather or whatever, or you just, you got some job where just driving the car is impractical. So that notwithstanding, driving the bus, you just look around at those people, and you should just thank your lucky stars that they're not in possession of an automobile and on the roads. Because, first of all, half the people on the bus are drunk. I mean, at any given moment. They always seem to be drunk and holding a huge bag of, like, cheese corn. And then just, like, scratching their ass and sniffing their fingers. And you look at them and you say, like, for the love of God, like, how is it that you even make it out of the house? It's like, how are you even able to get yourself dressed in the morning and, and make it out onto the sidewalk without further injuring yourself? So whatever keeps them, you know, if the $100,000 is what it takes to have somebody keep an eye on them so they're staying away from me, I'm all fine with that. I got no issue.
You have the thing where you drive by certain bus stops and you see the same people at the same bus stops all the time, and you actually start creating these sort of stories in your head about them and trying to figure out what their deal is?
I suppose, except I always just assume that it's one of those slow kids who always seems to be disproportionately large as well. You know what I mean? You have that kid who's like 6'5", but talks real, real slowly and takes forever to put together his sentences and lives with his mom in one of those places where the power hasn't gotten to it yet.
Yeah, when I lived in North Portland, we had a lot of midgets and a lot of people with no legs, and I would see them at bus stops and things. But a disproportionate number of midgets and dwarves living in North Portland, where I lived when I first lived there. Although they all seemed to, sort of leave.
What, was there some sort of a camp or something that had been set up for them? Or
I don't know, but this one guy, he actually apparently was a businessman downtown, and I would see him at the bus stop wearing a suit and a tie and a briefcase, but he was like a little miniature businessman.
Well, I guess that makes sense, because you got what's that place in Florida where all the circus freaks end up? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I forget
Sarasota,
the name of it. Yeah, but it's like where Lobster Boy and Clam Girl and Hatchet Head and, you know, whatever, whoever they are. They just all ended up in some, like, little mobile home, community down there. Because it's like, I guess if you're a circus freak, and I'm not saying midgets are circus freaks, in this case they were actual freaks from a circus, you probably want to be in a place where you can go to the store without somebody going like, and pulling their children away from you.
Yeah.
So it is with the smaller set.
That's true.
All right.
So North Portland then would be that place here in Portland?
Well, it sounds like it was maybe trending. That doesn't happen overnight. Hmm. That's sort of a gradual... You know,
So you think they all sort of shifted by mutual agreement to a different part of town?
Well, how long ago was this?
This was like probably 10 years ago.
You got to imagine that's a small community. So word probably travels, I would say, fast among those, because there's social organizations for little people and whatever. And it's like, especially you got little people who have specialized careers, such as like acting or whatever. You got to imagine they all kind of stay in touch with each other, like to a greater extent than regular-sized folk do. So it seems like there's a place where you can live where, you know, it's like you're not going to get gestured at and children aren't going to mock your diminutive stature. You know, that over time, the population might trend toward that kind of demographic makeup.
Hmm.
I'm just guessing. I don't really know.
Well, if any listeners know where in Portland now the largest... concentration of little people is. Please let me know.
So we can take a field trip
there. I
want
to know what happened to them.
So we can drive by in a bus and point slowly.
Speaking on Veterans Day at a U.S. Army garrison in South Korea, President Barack Obama drew parallels today between America's ally and North Korea, saying one is dynamic and growing, while the other would rather starve its people than change. But Mr. Obama said there's another path available to North Korea.
They choose to fulfill their international obligations and commitments to the international community. They will have the chance to offer their people lives of growing opportunity instead of crushing poverty.
Mr. Obama made a reference to South Korea's claim earlier this year that North Korea sank one of its vessels.
The alliance between our two nations has never been stronger. And along with the rest of the world, we've made it clear that the North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons will only lead to more isolation and less security for them.
By the way,
he started to lose control of that sentence. Did you hear that?
It sort of got away from him.
Yeah.
The alliance between our two nations has never been stronger. And along with the rest of the world, we've made it clear that the North Korea's pursuit
with the,
of nuclear
weapons the prompter's
will only
gone.
Lead to more isolation and less security for
as soon
them.
As he said the North Koreas, he like was, ah.
I wonder if you're a president now, if you just live in fear of talking like George W. Bush. You know, if he's just sort of a, if George W. Bush is some sort of linguistic failure specter that hovers over your shoulder, you know, and like the ghost of failed vocabulary past. Every time the North Koreas, and immediately you just see W like floating out of the audience. You know, sort of, you know, it's like that thing that hovers above.
Strategery!
Dan Aykroyd in Ghostbusters, just, you know, next you'll choke on snack foods. And you just, and in your head, you start to get a whole, oh, God, I'm turning into W. The only person I know who has ever spent any amount of time in North Korea, it was a friend of mine. He was a fellow DJ who went there. And I forget exactly why. It doesn't seem like, vacationing seems like the wrong word if you're hanging out in North Korea. But, you know, whatever. I don't know if he went there as part of some, as like a student group thing or what his deal was. But he went to North Korea and he said the single most unnerving thing about being in North Korea was when you would ask someone about the weather. And he started to do it every day because he wanted to see, you know, if it was just like a nationwide thing. He said that no matter where he was, no matter what time of day it was, no matter what the weather actually was like, if he asked a North Korean what the weather was like, they all gave, or, you know, what it was going to be like, they all gave him the same response, which is the, which is that our leader has ensured that it will be a glorious day today.
Oh, dear God.
And he, and it's like that just tells you everything you need to know. He said that he would be in totally separate parts of the city, and it would be, you know, like weeks apart, and he'd say, hey, you know what the weather's going to be today? Well, our leader has ensured that it's going to be a glorious day. And he said that it just became the single most frightening thing because he wondered what other questions he could ask them that they would all have the same answer to. He said he was never so glad to leave a country as he was when he got on the plane. Like when the guy said, like, we have cleared North Korean airspace. Like, it was just like the biggest exhale of his life.
Well, Obama also paid tribute to Americans who served in South Korea. Obama said the war was a victory not only for the Republic of Korea, but throughout Asia.
Today, the Korean Peninsula provides the world's clearest contrast between a society that is open and a society that is closed. Between a nation that is dynamic and growing and a government that would rather starve its people than change.
That's just nitpicking, though. You're listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. Don't forget, later on this hour, we have entertainment news coming up and the Rick Emerson radio program coming your way a little bit after 1 o'clock today. Today, we'll talk to columnist Anna Griffin from The Oregonian, also Mr. Mike Russell from CulturePulp.com about his recent interview with Berkeley Breathitt, Bloom County, Opus, and Outland creator, etc. This is Dawn Taylor.
That is me. After it reached 146th on the Amazon best-selling list, Amazon decided to...
You had a little Obama thing there where the sentence started to get away from you for just half a second.
I was trying to figure out where to dig into this.
Food on your family!
After skyrocketing to 146th on the Amazon best-selling list, the folks at Amazon decided to pull The Pedophile's Guide to Love and Pleasure, a self-published advice book. It reached 65th place, actually, before Amazon pulled it from the site. But between the coverage and the crash, his book, Philip Greaves' book, sparked debate about whether one of the world's largest e-book retailers has any guidelines for filtering what it sells. Amazon bans content it considers inappropriate, but doesn't explain what that might be. The book is described as an attempt to make pedophile situations safer for those juveniles by establishing certain rules for these adults to follow. And while it doesn't contain any particularly lurid advice, it did attract more than 800 angry customer comments.
So this is like, so it's like a NAMBLA book.
Yeah.
It's like one of those, if you're going to engage in child buggery, here's just like...
Here's how to do it in a respectful manner.
Here's what a safe word is.
Yeah.
All right.
Gawker suggested that this might have been Greaves' hope all along. To a certain extent, he wanted that notoriety to affect the book, he said in an interview with ABC News. I wanted it to affect sales. So he managed to, like, people got angry. It hit the press. That ended up making more people buy it.
Which, and, I mean, I'm trying to wrap my brain around. I don't even, If you were in the market for that book, it seems like Amazon, though, would be the last place that you would buy it. Mm-hmm. Because Amazon is one of, we've talked about this before, where it's like you go to Amazon and so they somehow just magically know stuff you've bought elsewhere. Because it'd be like, hello, Rick, perhaps you would enjoy. And then it shows me things that are stunningly similar to products that I bought at other websites. So wouldn't you figure that that river sort of runs both ways? If you're off buying some child-humping book at Amazon, the next time you go to your Netflix account, it's going to suggest something. It seems like that would filter out pretty quickly into areas of your life where you didn't want that necessarily known. So just in a self-preservational frame of mind, it seems like you wouldn't buy that at Amazon.
Even if you're not actually a pedophile, because I think that's the thing is that people just don't really think about that sort of thing. Because this started when the website TechCrunch, someone noticed that this book was on Amazon's list and that it had gotten all of these angry customer comments. When they wrote about it, it ranked 158,000 on the Amazon list. By the end of the day, it was at 146. And then finally it reached 65th place on the bestseller list before Amazon dumped it, which means that all of these people read about this on the internet and thought, this is funny, this is weird, this is a strange little thing that I'm going to buy and show my friends. And they bought it, and they're not thinking about the fact that this is now
in a database somewhere.
In a database that you bought the Pedophile's Guide to Love and Pleasure from Amazon.
Don't you just
with
sort of
your credit card.
Don't you just kind of figure that it's like that whole thing in, it's like that whole scene in Seven where Morgan Freeman goes and he gives the guy the envelope and the guy like comes back and tells him, you know, what books John Doe has been checking up in the library. Don't you just figure that there is a big database somewhere that when you buy stuff with certain words in the title, that it just gets flagged and put in a file?
Well, as terrible as that one that Mel Gibson movie was.
You're thinking conspiracy theory.
Terrible. As terrible as that movie was, as somebody who is interested in conspiracy theories, I thought a lot of the ways that some of the ways they dealt with conspiracy theories was kind of clever. And one of the things I really liked in the movie was that the database thing that would ping whenever somebody bought a copy of Catcher in the Rye.
Which totally makes sense.
Yeah. That, you know, if there is some kind of, and that is a big conspiracy theory, Catcher in the Rye is used in brainwashing potential, assassins that have been brainwashed and will be activated at some point, and Catcher in the Rye is part of the trigger mechanism, that, you know, you would want this thing that would alert you whenever somebody uses their credit card anywhere to buy a copy of Catcher in the Rye.
If you were going to brainwash somebody, why wouldn't you use like the Da Vinci Code or something that like everybody seems to own?
Well, the thing is, though, this has been going on. This particular theory started back in like the 60s when you had a lot of, I'm not sure if it goes all the way back to Sirhan Sirhan, but there are a lot of these political assassins who actually were found, and people who just went crazy and shot people were found with copies of Catcher in the Rye after they killed somebody and then were either killed by police or blew their own brains out.
Maybe they were just angry because they bought the book and realized it wasn't that good, and
that
they had to vent their frustration on somebody else. Why, this is just about an unlikable nebbish! I'll never get my $1.95 back! You're listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. We thank you for joining us. Right before the show, actually, I wanted to mention this. My phone rang just like 5 minutes before we were getting ready to go on, and it was our chief of staff, Cheryl Kanakoa. She was calling to let me know. Have you ever been to her place? It's like past where you live. It's like one of those Tim Riley places where you drive and you drive and you drive, and you swear to God, you're just going to plunge off the edge of the earth like the Crimson Permanent Assurance. You're just going to be like, well, I guess we've gone to the... and it's gone. And you just, you know, and it's like you're a langolier or something, where suddenly food has no taste and crickets don't make any noise, and then there's another expanse of houses like 40 miles away. So she's out there this morning. She's at her house. She calls me because, I swear to God, CJ's High Climbing Services out at her place.
Hey.
Because she lives in like a sort of a townhouse, you know, like a sort of a conglomeration of buildings. And so CJ's High Climbing Services out there like doing the power washing and washing out the gutters. Because, you know, most of the folks who work in or with the studio, you know, a lot of us live inside residential Portland. You know, you actually live out in Tualatin. But that means that they would go out to your place as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're just working inside the city. It's not like they're just, here for you living inside one of the regular Portland suburbs or something. They will go hither and yon, far and wide, to hell and breakfast and beyond. As my mother would say. CJ's High Climbing can be reached at cjshighclimbing.com, or you can call them at 503-228-9278. That is 503-222-9278. So if you live somewhere, you know, that's right in town, fine. If you live somewhere that's on the outskirts, if you live somewhere, you know, like way out in the boondocks, but you just look, and those are the places where you need it, too, because you just... That is a place where nature just seems like it's just one day away from reclaiming your house at any given moment. You know what I mean? Like, especially you get a strong wind or you get like some, I don't know, you get like either like a frost or something that's exceptionally strong or exceptionally, I don't know, weak or whatever. It's like one variable gets changed and then the next year it's like everything is just, it's like kudzu, just covering everything you own. So if you want to get that taken care of, and I know you do, you just contact CJ's High Climbing at 503-228-9278. Here's the other thing. This is a little confidential for me to like, I guess it's not confidential because I'm saying it here, but you know what I mean. It's November 11th. Like, with every day that you wait, every week that you wait, you're just going to be behind, like, other people who had the foresight to call before you did. So don't wait until Thanksgiving when everybody's sitting at home and they're looking around for, like, 4 days and they go, what should I do while I'm here? I guess this house needs to be cleaned on the outside and I need to have my yard taken care of. Don't be that guy. Be the guy who actually is ahead of that guy. Be the guy who calls early, gets it taken care of. They can actually give you estimates usually over the phone using Google Earth so you know up front what it's going to cost you. They can invoice you later, which means you don't have to stick around the house while they're doing it. You don't have to take time off from work. You find them at 503-228-9278. Do it right now. 503-228-9278. That is CJ's High Climbing Services. Here is Don Taylor.
It's time for science news.
Here's your science on the march for Wednesday right here at Legion of News.
In a bit of cellular wizardry, human skin cells have been turned into blood cells. The research could have huge implications for blood-related diseases, such as leukemia and lymphoma, and could also eventually lead to new treatments for other types of tissues inside the human body. According to Mick Batia, a scientist at McMaster University in Canada and co-author of the study, there is an incredible need clinically to generate red blood cells. But I think it will also expand the idea that skin cells could be directly turned into other cell types. The experiment was straightforward. The Canadian scientist first harvested skin cells from several human volunteers. The researchers then exposed those cells to a virus. The virus injected a gene known as OCT4 into the skin cells. OCT4 encodes a protein that acts as a kind of switchboard to activate other genes in order to make different kinds of cells. Bathed in a solution filled with cytokines, molecules that stimulate the immune system, the skin cells transformed into blood cells. By itself, this accomplishment is impressive. What makes it even more important is that the new blood cells persisted. They never reverted into an embryonic-like state, as has been the case with other research.
You know, the whole thing about cells transforming into other cells is just fascinating. I read this book about stem cells, and they were sort of trying to give an even-handed overview of the stem cell debate and what's real and what's a myth. And they described your body as essentially being like a library. And that different kinds of cells were different books that had knowledge about a specific thing. So like your kidney cells, you know, they know about being a kidney. The cells in your eye know about being an eye.
And your penis is the porn section.
Exactly. And they talked about your skin cell, though, you know, if each of those cells is a book, that a stem cell is effectively a library that has within it the instructions for becoming anything. But that as time goes on, certain doors to certain wings just become locked as they specialize. And the whole thing with stem cell research is they can actually take cells where those sections are closed off and they can open them up so the cell has all the knowledge it needs to become anything. And so theoretically, out of a single stem cell, you could in fact, I mean, if we had, you know, the additional knowledge required, we could in fact create an entire person from scratch. I mean, it's just the most fascinating thing.
Yeah, and this is kind of a big deal because red blood cells, actual, you know, healthy red blood that can be used in patients with like lymphoma and leukemia and various kinds of cancers and even non-blood cancers, it's kind of scarce. I mean, like you can walk into one of these plasma places and they'll do that thing, put you up with that machine where they'll take your plasma, but it pumps your red blood back into your body because they can take like a quart, you know, of plasma, the white blood cells, after they separate it out. But you need the red. If you're giving full blood, if you're giving whole blood, you can only give like a pint at a time.
Oh, is that the difference when they say that you're going to go down and give blood and you're going to give plasma? I didn't know there were places that actually only, that just took the plasma.
Oh, yeah. The places that you, that's the big thing, is to, that when you're selling stuff, as opposed to just donating to the Red Cross. If you donate to the Red Cross, you're donating whole blood and they'll only take a pint. Otherwise, you'll get like dizzy and pass out and fall down. But with the plasma, they can take like a quart. And essentially, you sit there for an hour and it goes into a machine that separates the red cells from the white cells.
Like a centrifuge,
yeah,
or something?
And it pumps the red blood cells back into your body. And so you can like sell them like a quarter of the stuff. But so, yeah,
says the voice of experience.
Oh yeah. I went to culinary school and I was poor. I sold a lot of plasma.
You said, now how much does your red blood go for?
Now I think the red blood. I don't know.
I mean the whole blood, the whole shebang. But I mean it's like, would you say it's, what does it go for compared to plasma?
I have no idea. I don't know. I've never sold whole blood. I don't know if there are even places that do that. I know that you donate blood to the Red Cross so that they have it in their bank and it can go to hospitals and stuff. You do that out of the kindness of your heart.
Oh, sure. Maybe you do think that of the kindness of your heart.
If you go to the white blood cell place, the plasma place, it's like they'll give you like $30.
For
like a quarter of your plasma.
Interesting.
And an hour of your time.
How often? I was going to ask how often you can do that.
I think you can come back. I think you can do it like every 3 days.
Interesting.
Every 2 or 3 days?
I mean, not that I necessarily have any plans to do it, but it is surprising, I guess, that more people don't do it. I mean, if you can do it every 3 days, let's say, so that's twice, we have $60, that's $240. So you're talking, that's like $3,000 a year.
A lot of people do it. There's three or four places that you can do it here in Portland. And the last time I went to one of these places, you know, it was like the middle of a weekday and there were like five or six people. It's to the point now where you have to like make an appointment to go at a certain time. So that they can, like, fit you in. A lot of people do that.
It seems like you could have a sort of a bustling business if you were the guy who actually just picked everybody up and took them to the plasma donation center. You know what I mean? Where you get, like, maybe 10% of whatever they make.
Yeah, you're like the plasma bus.
That's, seriously. You just get a plasma van where you just go, drive through, let's say, my neighborhood, and pack a whole bunch of people in there. You take them on down. They give you the 12%. You take them back home. Bam.
Yeah. Give them a cookie. Drop them off.
Just saying, a little money-making adventure idea from Rick Emerson to y'all. Here's Don Taylor.
Women aren't the only ones who feign pleasure in bed, according to a new study. Men fake orgasms as well. In a study of more than 200 college students, 25% of men and half of the women reported that they'd acted out an orgasm during sexual activity. The biggest motivation to fake it was wanting sex to end without the awkwardness of hurting their partner's feelings. The research is published in the November issue of the Journal of Sex Research. Studies have consistently shown that between half and two-thirds of women admit to having faked orgasm at some point. But because it's tougher for men to fake ejaculation than it is for women to fake a few moans, few researchers have looked at men's rates of artificial orgasm. The new study, carried out by psychologists at the University of Kansas, asked 180 college-age men and 101 college-age women about their sexual histories. Each participant was asked whether they had ever pretended to have an orgasm. To catch those who might be ashamed to admit it, the participants also were asked if they'd done something similar to pretending orgasm.
Do you have a friend who has done this, perhaps?
Almost 100% of those surveyed had experienced some sort of partnered sexual stimulation, whether manual or oral. Just under 70% of the women and 85% of the men reported penile vaginal intercourse. But intercourse turned out to be, of course, the major predictor of whether someone had faked it. About 10% of men and 19% of women who'd had sexual encounters but not intercourse had faked orgasm, compared with 28% of men and 67% of women who had had
it. So confusing. I feel like I knew what the story was about a minute ago, and now it's lost to me.
Basically, if you're just making out and somebody's doing something with their hands to you, I guess you don't feel the same sort of desire to, like, fake an orgasm as you do when you're...
Well, and if you're a guy, since that was sort of the hook of the article was that men fake it, it seems like if you're just... What did that Cosmo thing say?
Take off his pants.
If you're just receiving some sort of digital manipulation, it seems less plausible that you could fake the sexual fulfillment. It doesn't really seem like that's going to work all that well.
Yeah, no, I read something about this a couple of years ago that women are often very surprised to find out that men do sometimes, you know, fake orgasm. For the same reasons that women fake it. It's like, okay, I'm done, and I really don't want to be doing this anymore, and so... Oh, it's awesome. Yay.
See, maybe that is a totally foreign concept to, I'm not going to say to men, because I guess maybe not to some men, I guess I'm trying to wrap my head around how, because if you're a guy, you know, as opposed to being a woman, if you're a guy, unless there's some sort of medicinal or pharmaceutical aid involved, I mean, you can fake the orgasm, but it just seems like you can't fake sexual interest. And so, if you have the sexual interest, why would you not just want to... I mean, if you're on your way to the donut shop, why would you stop before you get there, is my thing.
Well, maybe for various reasons, you cannot. Like, it's just not happening for
you. That's what I mean. So maybe there's some sort of physical issue, or you have some kind of ailment where it's just not going to happen.
Or you're tired, or you've had a lot of... I don't know, you've had too much to drink, and you're a little numb.
I was under the impression that if guys had too much to drink, it was just that there was no starting the car to begin with. You
also,
know.
Some men...
It wasn't like you couldn't find the store. You just couldn't... The car, there was no spark plug to be had there.
Also, some men, can last for a considerably longer time than other men.
Fair enough.
And maybe at some point during, they just started realizing, I don't really think I want to be doing this anymore. My legs are starting to hurt. She's just said some really annoying things, and I don't like her anymore. I want to go get a pizza.
Okay, now see, that might actually be... I could almost buy that final reason, you know? Or if you're there and the chick just says, you know... If the chick just starts saying something that maybe indicates to you that perhaps this isn't a person you want to spend a great deal of time with.
Yeah, but you're already in the middle of it, and it's like, oh, God, now what?
I will tell you this, actually. Now, this is... we're getting into this whole area of things we shouldn't talk about. Because we've only got 19 minutes left.
I'm going to revisit this later.
It's going to be awkward for everybody. You are listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. This hour's fine programming brought to you by, among other folks, Castalia Language Center. And yes, I get confused by the whole Castalia-Cascadia thing, too. But we're just going to plunge on ahead because I have yet to screw that up. Castalia Language Center can be found out more about. That was an unfortunate rhyme and also didn't make any sense. Plus, I ended things with a preposition.
Strategery!
Find out more about them at PortlandSpanish.com. See, here's the thing about Spanish. Spanish doesn't have any of these problems. I guess you can make a mess of your Spanish if you really want to, but it's a lot harder because everything just, you know, there's a place for everything and everything in its place. Usually, putting sentences together in Spanish is like playing that perfection game. You know, when you're a kid. Like, you either put things in the right place or the whole thing isn't going to work. There's no just putting it there and just kind of faking your way through it. You can find out more about them at PortlandSpanish.com. That is PortlandSpanish.com. They specialize in Spanish language classes for adults, which means that if you've graduated from high school or college and you felt like you ought to be able to speak Spanish because you took Spanish classes and yet, miraculously, you can't, well, that's because you were just learning it probably the wrong way. And you weren't even really learning it. You were just committing it to memory. You were putting it in your RAM, basically. It was just RAM, yes?
You're putting it on a floppy disk.
Not even on
And we don't even use those anymore, so no wonder it's gone.
Okay, good save there, because I was going to say that's not really the same thing. It's like is it the RAM or the whatever they used to have? It's like when you would turn off the computer, but the thing wasn't saved.
No, I don't know.
It wouldn't be RAM. What is the computer term I'm looking for? Because your computer has RAM now, although maybe that's not where things are actually saved. See, this is where it all falls apart for me, because I have just enough knowledge to make the RAM reference, but I don't actually know the difference, because it's like my VIC-20 when I was a kid. That had RAM, right? But you turn everything off and it's gone, unless you put it on that tape drive, which nobody wanted, by the way, which is like the most ghetto accessory you could possibly find for your goddamn tape drive. Like, it's so much harder to just buy the Commodore 64. Anyway, doesn't matter. So rather than just memorizing stuff and just thinking you can come up with it later and then sound like you're speaking Spanish, it's just not going to work. So now that you are an adult, or as Tom Waits would say, now we are mature. So you can learn some Spanish at Castalia Language Center, and they're going to find the Spanish level that works best for you. So if you've already got it down but you need to polish it, or if you've got some in-between level of Spanish acumen, they can work that. But if you're just learning it right out of the gate, if you're just learning it from scratch, they can help you with that as well. And they're going to find a day and a time that works with your schedule, and you're going to be in a class of no more than 7 other people, so you're going to get near individualized attention. Do yourself and your brain a favor. Your older self a favor. Your older self will thank you. Your future, 80-year-old self who still remembers where the car keys are, he'll thank you for learning another language.
And can look for them in Spanish.
That's what I'm saying. ¿Dónde
es? ¿Cómo está el car keys?
No. It's ¿dónde? I got nothing.
¿Dónde está la keys de automóvil?
Well, that might actually work, because...
Well, not keys, though. There's a word for keys.
Yeah, but it might be keys. You don't know.
Probably not.
All right.
If I spoke Spanish, I would know this.
PortlandSpanish.com. Here's Don Taylor.
Robots and other machines equipped with artificial intelligence shoot military targets, distribute cash, think ATMs, drive cars, and deliver medication to patients, to name a few things that they do. If people performed these duties, they would be expected to behave in a certain way and follow moral and ethical guidelines. But what about robots, Rick Emerson?
What about robots, Don Taylor?
They can't think and act on their own accord.
Sure,
so
they can't.
Should we expect them to behave morally? Researchers working in the field of machine ethics say yes, and are investigating ways to program machines to behave morally. Philosopher Susan Anderson and her research partner and husband Michael Anderson, a computer scientist, have programmed a robot to behave in an ethical manner. Based on certain facts and outcomes, the robot must weigh a decision and make choices about what to do. The situation is rooted in the medical field, where the robot's duties involve reminding patients to take their medicine. A human would judge how often to remind a patient to take medicine and whether or not to inform the doctor if the patient refuses to take the medicine. But how do you program a robot to do that?
Well, that doesn't seem that difficult. I mean, I don't know how to actually program things, but the logic of that, it just seems like a flowchart, right?
Well, I guess.
You just like when you're programming the robot, you say, look, if the patient doesn't take the medicine, you tell me. And then when the robot gets to that particular, hey, the patient hasn't taken the medicine. Oh, tell doctor.
But what if the patient says, please don't tell the doctor? Then the robot has to go, oh, no, what will I do?
Well, and you just.
Who is my loyalty truly to? They created a software program based on an approach to ethics developed in 1930 by Scottish philosopher David Ross. The so-called prima facie duty approach takes into account the different obligations a person must face, such as being just, doing good, not causing harm, keeping a promise, when deciding how to act in a moral way. In the case of a patient taking medicine, the robot's program weighs the potential benefits the patient will have if she takes the medicine, the harm that may come to her if she doesn't, and also her right to autonomy. In the video demonstration that was shown to folks, the robot reminds the patient to take the medication, and then after the patient says no a couple of times, the robot finally decides to tell the doctor.
Yeah, because, I mean, because I think they've, otherwise the liability bot comes and hauls you into robot court, and then you lose your license to practice. You're talking about the sort of vague kind of like, shall I break the window and steal this bread to feed my hungry child bot kind of thing?
Eventually, sure.
Okay.
You know. If I was the robot, I don't think that you should actually, tell the person that you're gonna snitch on him, because they could probably just turn you off.
It seems like if you're a patient and you're being tended to by a robot, you're probably at that point so convinced that you're just high or already dead or hallucinating that it really doesn't matter at that point. I mean, imagine if you were just in bed, you know, and it's like a robot just wheels itself and it's time for your enema, you know, and it's just like you just...
Well, yesterday there was the one that they taught it to give sponge baths.
Well, that was it. What was it that in Switzerland, the robot is in the basement just punching guys all day or something?
Yeah.
Because the robot, they're trying to teach it the limits of human pain tolerance. So it's like, and that I swear to Christ, they had a robot and its sole job was just to belt a guy in the chops every day, you know, for like hours on end. And then the next stage of the, I am not making this up, the next stage of the experiment was they were going to give the robot like a pointy stabby tool, like a shiv. You know, from the mess hall or something that it made by filing down a toothbrush in the yard during walks, and then the robot was just going to be like sticking a guy with it.
Yeah,
it's a weird world. All right,
that's all the science.
There you go. There's your. That's enough, I think, for one day. Christ. Hey, did you ever hear the newsbot that we had at?
I did.
AM 970.
I liked the newsbot.
I liked the 970. I love the newsbot. You know who didn't love the newsbot was. Was the general manager or the vice president of the company or anybody else in upper management who ever heard it. They were not fans of the newsbot. Okay, it was like, less newsbot, more Timmy Ryan. You know, it's like, it's your choice. Yeah, that's on you, human.
More newsbot, please.
Yes, here's Don Taylor.
The Washington State Liquor Control Board on Wednesday banned the sale of alcoholic energy drinks after a group of college students got sick from consuming a drink nicknamed Blackout in a Can. Oklahoma, Utah, and Michigan have banned alcoholic energy drinks last week. Now Senator Chuck Schumer wants New York to do the same thing.
I was like, this is loco?
Yes.
So let me just say, by the way, that I was at the Plaid Pantry last night. Guy in front of me buying not one, not two, not three, not four, five cans of Four Loko all at once, and a six-pack of something.
I'm going to try and remember to take a picture of this tonight. After we read this, first started reading these stories about the Four Loko, I went to this convenience store by my house. And I pulled up, it's like a gas station and a convenience store, and I pulled up, and they have, I swear to God, on the outside, the big floor-to-ceiling windows where they put all of the advertising, sort of the cigarettes and the beer thing, this display thing that's vinyl stickers of Four Loko cans that I swear to God are 4 feet high by like a foot and a half across, and then four of them in a row, just like... huge Four Loko cans. It's the biggest display in the window of this convenience store.
Well, you know, because because the writing is on the wall with those guys. I mean, it's obvious that they're going to get legislated out of business because it's the government's job to babysit you, and so they're just making it. You know, you got to make hay while the sun is shining before Chuck Schumer gets his grubby hands on your business. So they got to make it fast while you can, as fast as you can. But what they really ought to be doing right now, and there's a little bit of free advice from me to the Four Loko people, although, you know, your marketing folks have obviously thought of this idea already. They ought to be rolling out advertisements. They're like, banned in 5 states. And then just double the price.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was running the Four Loko, and I don't know if they got a parent company. Like, they're not owned by Anheuser-Busch or something. Are they? Do we know?
No,
I mean,
they're owned by that Fusion.
Oh, that's right. It's like some weird Dow chemical, you know,
something.
Makers of Dekron, one of those companies.
Yeah.
Because it's probably just runoff from like a toxic sludge place or something. But yeah, they ought to just double the price and then just tell you how many places exist where you can't buy it. Because it's just a matter of time before they're going to wake up and they're going to have a warehouse full of that stuff. Hey, let me ask you a question. Is it legal? And it's almost certainly not. Is it legal? Like if you go to the store and buy yourself a can of beer, can you then sell it to somebody else if it's unopened? Could you sell it to Sarah for a dollar?
I don't know.
I just wonder.
Legally, I don't know.
I don't know. If somebody knows, because Rick Emerson's thinking a Four Loko reselling business, especially about a year from now, that's going to pay dividends.
I'm assuming not, because I know there's that whole thing with like private parties where you have some kind of a thing where if you don't have like somebody from the OLCC or whatever there, if you're going to have drinks,
right.
You have to like take an entry fee and then give them drink tickets, which they can exchange for a drink. Which means that you're not selling booze.
True. Well, and I guess that makes sense because, you know, like radio stations and stuff, like we could never give away booze as a prize.
Yeah.
There was a whole thing where people had to buy, and you couldn't even give away like a discount. People had to like buy it on their own. You could give them tickets to a bar, but they couldn't have tickets to stuff, you know, to stuff they could drink.
Yeah, that's all FCCs. I mean, I'll bet you we could give away, or if not here, then on our own show, on Rick Emerson's show, I'll bet we could give away booze. You couldn't sell it to somebody, but we could probably give away bottles of whiskey or something.
I had that whole idea. I don't even know if I mentioned this. I had this whole idea where I just wanted to give. I just wanted to collect booze for the homeless. Was that a thing we talked about on the air? Was that just in my head?
No, we talked about that.
Yeah, which I still think is a great idea, by the way, because really, who needs booze more than the homeless? Like no one. So just the homeless and the unemployed. We had to just which are often one and the same these days. Just raise money and then just use it to give big bottles of alcohol to the homeless and the unemployed.
I'm seeing an underserved holiday time niche. That we can serve.
So to speak.
You know?
All right. Well, in any event, Chuck Schumer says...
Yes, says this.
All right, Schumer says what?
I'm calling on the state liquor authority to ban caffeinated alcoholic drinks like Four Loko in New York State, asking other liquor authorities in other states to do the same.
Seriously, I got to tell you, I wish Chuck Schumer and all elected officials a long life and the best of health. All government employees, I wish them nothing, a mazel tov from me to you, and I hope that you live a long, happy, and healthy life. God forbid, though. I mean, God forbid that something, unfortunate, should happen. Never mind. I'm not even going to continue this line of conversation, but I'm just going to say so this is in New York and in Utah they're talking about it and in Colorado.
They've already banned it in Oklahoma, Utah, and Michigan.
They're always the leaders of the No Fun Club, by the way, most of those places.
Yeah. In a breathtaking grasp of the obvious, Washington Governor Chris Gregoire says the brightly colored can's sweet taste and cheap price is designed to encourage young people to drink.
That's no different than the appeal of Joe Camel to young kids to get them engaged in smoking.
Okay.
Young kids didn't start smoking because of Joe Camel.
Well, even if they do, and this, I mean, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't care. If your kid takes up smoking at like, at like 12, that's one less person that I have to take care of when they're 60. So I don't care. But it is different because no one is making the accusation that kids are drinking Four Loko. That's the thing.
No one at all.
That is the little, that's the problem with this sophistry that she's trying to peddle on us here, is she does that not very cleverly executed rhetorical trick of leaping from one track to another, of saying, the Four Loko having the brightly colored can and the sweet taste and the whatever is no different than, change of tracks, children smoking cigarettes. Because no one none of these legislators have made the accusation that children are drinking Four Loko. And in fact, the kids who did drink it, who all blacked out, were all over the age of legal liquor consumption, if I remember the story correctly.
They're college
students. So, yeah. So, I mean, it's like they're just, but I think they were all, but it's not just that. I think they were all over 21.
Yeah. But even if they are under 21, but they're college students, Four Loko isn't teaching them to drink. They're college students.
Yeah.
If they're not drinking the Four Loko, they're going to be drinking something else.
Stetson. All right. Well, in any event, you're listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. We thank you for joining us. Don't forget the Rick Emerson radio program comes up shortly after 1 o'clock today. We'll be talking to cartoonist and film critic Mike Russell. Find out more about him at Culture Pulp. You can listen to him today on the Rick Emerson radio program. He's going to be talking about lots of things, including his recent interview with Bloom County mastermind Berkeley Brether. We'll also talk to Anna Griffin, columnist from The Oregonian. Legion of News brought to you by, among other fine businesses, Squires Electric. That is, and every time I say Squires Electric, I have to fight off the urge to say it like that guy in That Thing You Do who goes, you know, hello, young squire. And then he just sends the guy off to the...
Yeah,
see?
I love that guy.
My name's Lamont, and this is my hotel. And we take care of people here. It's SquiresElectric.com. That is SquiresElectric.com. It's where you can find out, or as Don Taylor would say, SquiresElectric.com. You can also call them if you like. It's 503. Everybody in the audience knows what I'm talking about. It's 503-252-1609.
503. Do I say .com funny?
Well, you don't say it funnily. You say it different than most people, but it's part of your charm. Yes, you do. You say many things differently. You have a strange way of accenting words. Oh. You stress... you do to words like .com and phrases like 7-Eleven, you do to those what I do to YouTube and eBay, where they somehow, in my brain, and I blame Don Geronimo for this, they become YouTube and eBay. So you do that with certain things as well, and the people know what I'm talking about. It's you know, I've never pointed it out before because I want you to be, you know, I didn't know if it was a thing you were doing, like, zanally, or if it was just a thing, if you just said it that way because you said it that way.
Apparently I was unaware I was doing it.
All right, well, whatever you do, don't fixate on it now.
Oh, no.
Don
no,
Taylor.
That won't happen.
503-252-1609 is how you contact Squires Electric. And you can find out more about them at SquiresElectric.com. They do free estimates, no job too small, no job too large, and sometimes people just say that, but they don't really mean it. They do mean it. In fact, I found out that this condominium that they were wiring, and it was an I don't mean like they just went in and like fixed some stuff or just tweaked the existing wire. Literally, it was a building that didn't exist. Somebody constructed the entire building from scratch, and then Squires went in and they wired every socket, every plug, every light, every room, and every floor of the building. And I swear to God, this sounds so impossibly like Horatio Alger that but it's true. That the guy who built the condominium that they just wired every single every single room and outlet for. Started his relationship with Squires when he had them come to his home to fix, I swear to God, a single bulb, like a single or a single socket, you know, an outlet thing. It didn't want to work. A single outlet in one room. And then now a couple years later, they're doing the guy, like an entire building that the guy had constructed. So,
but they came back to do like it as a big job. It hasn't been like one thing at a time, like the Winchester Mystery House.
No, this is actually, it's possible. No, that's actually one of the reasons why Joe Squires has not been able to visit the show because they've been off finishing this building. But they first met this customer years ago when he had them come back because it was like one single outlet in the house that didn't work for some reason. They fixed it. They met the guy. Then so that was how their customer relationship with him began. And now years later, they're doing the whole place. So they've been around for a long time. They've been here for, going on 15 years. And you can find out more about them at 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. And they're good people. And I can say that. We've spent time with them. They are, they're good folks, as your president would say. 503-252-1609. Squires Electric. Let's do like one more here and we'll wrap it up.
All right. In his new autobiography, Life, Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards says that everything in the book is true. Warts, groupies, needles, and all. Richards makes certain that no one gets more ridicule than himself, but his close second is Rolling Stones bandmate and childhood friend Mick Jagger. It was the beginning of the 80s when Mick started to become unbearable, Richard says, about his ambivalent friendship with Jagger.
Which is awesome because it's like almost 30 years ago.
Richard's unflattering pet names for Jagger, among others, are Your Majesty and Brenda, for his sanctimonious, imperious nature.
Brenda?
Brenda. Richards also says he hasn't in 20 years entered Jagger's dressing room. Richards did show his manuscript to Jagger prior to publication and says that there was only one complaint the singer wanted to blue pencil out. Richards, however, refused to excise a secret about Jagger having used a voice coach. Interesting, since Richards writes about Jagger's diminutive fifth appendage and fast finish passion plays. We've had our beefs, but hey, who doesn't, Richard says. You try and keep something together for 50 years.
I guess it's weird, actually, that he, or maybe not so weird, that Jagger would not want the thing about the vocal coach known.
But he's okay with Richard's talking about him having a tiny penis.
He's got a tiny wang and that he's like a Minuteman or whatever, because, I mean... you think that if one didn't bother him, the other wouldn't, because, you know, his attitude about the whole penis thing must be like, hey, I'm Mick Jagger. F it. It doesn't matter. Yeah, like, you know.
It's not like it's going to keep me from getting laid.
Yeah, I mean, it's like his satisfaction remains the same, so to speak, I would imagine. The vocal coach thing's a little weird.
Yeah.
I don't know. The Brenda thing, is that like a British? Is that an Englishism, do you suppose?
Sounds like a British thing, yes.
I like that, though.
I like the idea of calling someone who's kind of... I'm going to start calling you Brenda when you get too imperious.
Thank you. Are you going to say that it was just like, it was just slightly after the program's launch when I became unbearable?
Yes.
Perhaps not even after the program's launch? Unbearable is a great way to put it, and that it wasn't just like recently, that it was in fact like at the beginning, it was like 29 years ago that he started to become unbearable. It's like having a pain all up and down your right side or something that, well, it just started to get really awful back in 1972. I should have something done about it. The thing is, I'm resisting buying that book because it's in hardcover, and so it's going to be like $35 or something.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, even if I were to get it for Christmas or something, it's like I almost don't want a hardcover book at this point because, you know, then they screw you by putting out the supplementary chapter, like when it comes out in paperback, and then I have to buy it all over again. So, and there's no way the library is going to have it, available anytime soon. So I'm just, it's paining me that book exists and I can't. And then there's that year turnaround time now between hardcover and paperbacks.
And then there's that director's cut that comes out later with the commentary track all in footnotes on every page.
You lie, but I'm telling you, Elijah Wald, who's an author that I read, did exactly that. Put out a book, I swear to God, that had a commentary on a CD with it accompanied the writing of the book. So, and it's like I was obliged to buy it for the third time. All right, that is your entertainment news, and that is your Legion of News for Thursday, November 11th, 2010. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget, you can get this program later on the day via iTunes as well as a direct MP3 download here at legionofnews.com or here at cascadia.fm. The Rick Emerson Show comes up next with Mr. Mike Russell of Culture Pulp, Anna Griffin from The Oregonian, and more. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer. Mr. Bruce Agle, Chief of Staff, Cheryl Kanakoa. And always, thank you for listening. We will see you again tomorrow at noon. Have a satisfying and productive Thursday, won't you?